And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, August 3rd, already 2016. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are J.J. Amaworo-Wilson and Eden Lapuki. First up is J.J. Amaworo-Wilson. J.J. was born in Germany, the son of a Nigerian mother and an English father, but grew up in the U.K. He's also lived in Egypt, Colombia, South Africa, where he ran a theater and worked for the anti-apartheid movement, Italy, and most recently the United States, where he is writer-in-residence at Western New Mexico University. He's here today to primarily talk about his novel, Damnificados. It was named a top 10 pick list on O, the Oprah Winfrey magazine of 2016, and was named number one on Book Riot's Books to Read in January list. Let's bring him on. Hi, JJ.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
There you are. I'm great. I'm so glad to talk with you about Damnificados. Let's begin by you talking about how the book came about.
Oh, how the book came about. Well, that's kind of an interesting story. I was on a book tour in Caracas in Venezuela, and one very late night, I was a little sleepless and jet-lagged, so I took a stroll through the city, and I was walking through all these dangerous areas. You know, Caracas is full of slums, and there's a lot of very, very poor areas in the city, and I walked and I walked and I walked for hours until I finally came across this enormous tower, which I later learned was called the Torre David, the Tower of David. And it looked kind of interesting because it was unfinished, but there were people living in it. So to make a long story short, I did some research on this tower, and I discovered that it had been built in the 90s, and then it was never finished because money ran out. And so you had this huge tower doing nothing, sitting empty in the middle of Caracas. And so one night, hundreds and hundreds of damnificados moved in, the homeless, ex-drug addicts, alcoholics, ex-gang members, people who'd struggled all their lives. They moved in and squatted it. And they managed to build this incredibly functioning community within this tower, within Torre David. And I just thought it was an amazing story of self-reliance and people who'd basically been shunned by society, been oppressed. They managed to create their own community in this tower and lived in it for 7 years before they were evicted. Hmm. So that's the sort of origin story.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, one thing that's interesting, too, is maybe a two or three or four part question, because you had published nonfiction books, and here is this thing going on in the city that could be another nonfiction, narrative nonfiction book. And so were you fishing around for something to really base a novel on, or did it come to you in novel form? Did you see it more as something to begin with and fictionalize? And did it ever appear to you as maybe this is a narrative nonfiction book about this high rise and how it went up and how these people took it over, on and on?
Well, that's a great question. I'd been publishing short fiction for many years, for maybe 15, 20 years. So I wrote a lot of short stories, and I started writing about it not knowing what it was going to be. I didn't have in mind that this is necessarily going to be a novel. I just started writing, and as I found the voice of the novel, the narrator, and as I started developing the characters, I realized it was getting too big for a short story. I also didn't want to write a nonfiction piece because I thought the story was so amazing that to do it justice, I really wanted to build up these characters and give them their own stories, and I'd have had to do so much research to do that in nonfiction, mm-hmm. whereas fiction obviously gives you more scope. You can invent stuff, and that's what I was really interested in doing. So, no, it it didn't start out necessarily as, you know, me thinking this is going to be a novel. It's just the way it turned out. It's such a great story. And living with those characters for so long, they just grew and grew and grew. And that's how it became a novel.
Interesting. Yeah, when you started talking about it, you mentioned finding the voice of the novel. And I wonder if you can track back and at all remember how that happened.
Wow. I wish that's something I could remember, how it happens. I honestly,
were you writing for a long time before the voice came? Or how did that go?
Yeah. No, it wasn't a long time. I love the story so much. And I think I found the voice within a few weeks of writing, because I would sit at my desk and write every day. And once you get into that kind of rhythm, and once you find that kind of musicality in your writing, so that the writing is, you know, it's rhythmic and it has euphony, and it just starts to flow like a piece of music. Once I'd found that, you know, again, I'm not sure how it happened, but it happened pretty early on. That I found the tone, which, as you know, there's an element of magical realism. There's a certain darkness to the novel, simply because the people have been oppressed so long. But there's also humor. And once I'd found that, it really flowed quite easily. But the question of how did I find it, well, I have no idea.
Well, maybe you said it. You sat down every day.
Yeah, I guess that's it. Yeah.
Sometimes it's the sitting down every day and allowing it to come versus waiting till you have it, kind of full form or born. It's sitting there, which is difficult, right?
Absolutely. That really reminds me of something the British novelist Philip Pullman said. I think he said something like, I don't know where my ideas come from, but I know where they come to.
Mm.
They come to my desk, and if I'm not there, they go away again.
Yeah.
So he's trying to say, you know, you have to be at your desk working at it, otherwise the ideas won't come. And that was certainly the same for me.
Yeah. I would love to hear you read from Damnificados. Now, pronounce it for me again.
Damnificados.
Okay. And that's means homeless.
No, it's Spanish for, it's more like the doomed or the damned,
okay.
Not specifically homeless.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did that, before you read, tell me how that title came.
Well, I was back in Caracas. I'd just seen a tower. I hailed a taxi to get back to my hotel, and I asked the taxi driver who the people were living in this tower. I said, ¿Quién son? And he replied, son los damnificados. They are the damnificados. So this taxi driver, who I have no idea what his name is, I just remember him very clearly, he gave me the title of the book.
Interesting. Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay, yep. Okay, well, I'm going to read, I'll read a short section from very early on in the book, and if there's time, I can read another section a little further on. You tell me if there's time.
Okay.
Okay. The skyscraper was the third tallest building in the city, and from the highest floor you could look down on the backs of birds gliding on air. The building had stood empty for a decade, pockmarked by bullet holes, paint peeling in the sun, flaking away like a layer of skin, and a posse of graffiti artists had looped their messages in cartoon writing on the back of the building, Libertad. Torre de mierda, cojones, viva la revolución, and a fresco of soldiers in silhouette marching to hell. Surrounded as it was by low rises, the monolith took on the aura of a bully. With its 600 eyes, it watched the world, and its shadow moved like the hands of a clock, blotting out the surrounding bodegas and wastelands and cinder block houses for minutes at a time. Over that decade, the glass had fallen out the windows or been smashed by stray birds and bats till the building's eyes were hollows. And with the glass gone, the wind lassoed its ghost whistles around and through the skyscraper's neck, shooting in and out of its arteries and whooshing down its lungs. Some winter days, the building would sway like a dancer.
Hmm.
So that's from the opening.
Yeah, we have time for more.
Yeah, okay. I'll move it on a few pages because, as I mentioned, the homeless then move in. They move in with something of a struggle, which I'm not going to give away. But this is from page 19. The families move in. Those with the elderly take the lower floors. They bring in furniture, lanterns, candles, everything reclaimed from the dumps. Some have stoves and even refrigerators. They make beds from pallets and recycled planks. Old sofas come in from the dumpster at Minas. A hotel burns down at Puerta Rota, and the damnificados head out at 3 a.m. to salvage beds and wardrobes, loading them onto the father's truck and hanging off the sides as it winds its way back to the tower. They stalk the rich areas for abandoned TVs and pull them off the sidewalk. Lalu fixes everything electrical after Nacho lets him stay in a room on the sixth floor. His hands shake, but he can find his way around electrics in his sleep. And for weeks he goes from floor to floor, fixing everything in exchange for food and wine. A riot breaks out south of Agua Suja, and in the chaos, six brothers somehow bring a baking oven home to the tower, marching it like a coffin in a cortege. It takes them all night to haul it to the tower, and when they arrive, their hands and shoulders are bleeding. They set it up the next day on the third floor and open a bakery. On the sixth floor, Maria Benedetti, an ex-beauty queen from Sanguinosa, sets up a salon. She uses pilfered combs and brushes, shampoo made from soap and goat's milk, and a hairdryer that was her mother's.
Lovely.
And so it goes on. And this is the description of them setting up the community in the tower. And, of course, the tower has this kind of a microeconomy going on there. It has beauty salons. It has little restaurants, little shops on every floor. It has a little church. It has schools. It has it's its own self-contained community.
Hmm. Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. That was J.J. Amororo Wilson reading from Damnificados, and it was published by PM Press. And, wow, yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the setting. The skyscraper is fascinating. There's something about an unoccupied skyscraper that just befuddles the brain. And early on in the book, there's a rainstorm, a monsoon, something that goes on for days and days. And I began to feel the dampness, which is interesting because, you know, Southern California is a desert and we haven't had rain in quite some time. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about writing setting and getting it as you did. And I believe, I don't know if you lived in New Mexico when you wrote the book, but you know,
I did, yeah.
Interesting to talk about setting and how you got it so right.
Well, that's interesting because the book is set in an imaginary city. Even though the real tower is in Caracas in Venezuela, the city, Favelada, where the book is set, is really a composite of all the cities I've been to, and that's a lot. You know, I've traveled to around 60 countries in my whole life, and really the city, it's not just Caracas, it's also Cairo. There are mosques there. It's London because it's so multicultural. It's New York. It's Istanbul. It's Lagos. It's all the places I've ever been to. And the flood, yeah, I hadn't seen a flood for a long time because I live in New Mexico, but I did live in Bogota in Colombia. And there were violent rainstorms. Same every time I go to Brazil in the summer, you get these sudden violent rainstorms. And really, the flood in Damnificados is based on my observations of being in Bogota during a rainstorm, which, I mean, really, it can rise to 2 or 3 yards within about half an hour. And it's astonishing. And what it reminds you of, if you're that way inclined, is a biblical flood. It's that violent and that destructive. And of course, the book Damnificados has various elements of the Bible in it. That flood, for example, and also, you know, several reviewers noticed that it's a David and Goliath story, with David being the Damnificados, fighting against the government and the military, which is Goliath. So there's an element of the Bible in it, but the setting, certainly, the setting for the novel is really a composite of the cities I've been to, and things like the flood that you mentioned is based on my observations of these floods, in particularly in Latin America.
Do you keep journals in your travels?
Yes. I've kept journals for the last 25 years, and they're a mix of sort of literary and everyday observations.
Mm-hmm.
And I rely heavily on them. I have a terrible memory, so I have to write everything down.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's great. Where did the character of Nacho come about? How did he come from? Where did he come from? Yeah.
Well, I guess there are obviously elements of me in him, his idealism. But then there are elements of all kinds of, I suppose you would call them revolutionaries. There's a little bit of the great Brazilian educator Paulo Freire in there. There's a little bit of Frantz Fanon, who helped Algeria find independence. There's a little bit of Che Guevara. There's, you know, he really is a composite of many people that I admire. And again, as I was saying, the character just grew and grew and grew. Now, the one thing I didn't want was to have a superhero as the main character. I didn't want someone who was basically perfect, who looked like a New York male model and was moral and this perfect human being. And that's why he's on crutches. That's why he's known as El Pequeño Lisiado, the little cripple.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's tiny. He's about 5 foot tall. Because I wanted someone who had some physical damage, because all the characters in Damnificados are damaged in some way, and I wanted the hero to be damaged too, physically, but of course, spiritually, ethically, mentally, he's a giant. He's a powerhouse that drives all of the Damnificados to their place of safety, which is the tower, a little bit like Moses leading his people.
Hmm.
So I'm talking a lot about composites. You know, the main character is a composite. The setting is a composite.
Well, isn't that, I would think that's how most novels come about. You know, I think if you're basing a novel on something actual, it's probably not going to end up being that good of a novel. And it seems that at least most of my favorites are composites. Yeah, composites of characters, experiences, places.
Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly the way it is for me, yeah.
So we are getting to the end of our time already, and I read a few of your Goodreads reviews, which seem to be overwhelmingly positive, and you have readers wishing for a sequel.
Oh, do I? Oh,
you
I
do.
Have
you
out.
Have.
Okay.
You do, and I'm wondering if there are any plans for a sequel.
You know, I've already started on something different, a new novel, which is not a sequel. I'm very pleased that people want more, but I honestly reached closure with Damnificados a couple of years ago. Even though the book was only published this year, obviously I finished writing it a couple of years ago. And for me, it's done. I have no more to say on that particular story, and I would like to. I don't want to ruin. I don't want to ruin anything by writing a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a Marvel comic.
Right.
I think it stands alone, and that's how I'd rather keep it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you know? You just mentioned writing it a couple of years ago, or a couple of years before it was published. Did you sell it with an agent, or what was your route to publication?
No, I had an extraordinarily untypical route to publication. I decided I didn't necessarily need an agent. I've been publishing for over 20 years. I know how to read a contract, and I decided to go it alone. And I did a lot of research into publishing houses that I thought might be interested. I sidestepped the big five. I didn't even bother with them because I felt they weren't right for my novel. What I really wanted was a medium-sized, established, independent publisher who would really treat the novel with respect and really throw everything into the marketing of it. I think if you go with the big five, what can sometimes happen is that if you don't sell a million copies within a month, they sometimes drop you.
Yeah.
Or you sort of go to the bottom of their list. Understandably, it's a capitalist business. It's all about making money. So I wanted a medium-sized independent company, but I also wanted a company that was interested in progressive ideas, and PM Press is that company. They they publish a lot on civil rights, human rights, the environment, gay and lesbian issues, etc. And I felt they would be a good fit for Damnificados. They were the only publisher I sent it to. Within a week, they said they were interested. I flew over to Oakland, where they're based. I chatted with the boss there, and he said an extraordinarily untypical thing to me. Instead of flattering me, he said, "This is a debut novel. It will probably sink without trace, but we want to publish it because we believe in it."
Hmm.
So when someone is that honest and open with you, I really felt they were the publisher for me, and I've had no regrets whatsoever.
Hmm.
PM Press is a great publisher and produces great books, and I'm glad I'm with them.
Love that story. I love that story. In closing, I wonder if you have any words of wisdom or advice for the writers listening.
Oh, that's an interesting one. Yeah. there are things that you'd have heard 100 times if you're an aspiring writer. Like, you know, you have to write every day, you have to write regularly, all those sort of typical things. I would say this: don't worry too much about what the public wants. If the public knew what they wanted, they'd all be writing it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to find your own voice. Honestly, I could go on forever with advice to writers. One thing I heard, if you get writer's block, have a man with a gun burst through the door.
Mm-hmm.
That was Ray Chandler. But really, I think the key thing is just perseverance. Everyone says, "I've got an idea for a novel." Well, ideas are no use. You got to get them on paper. You've just got to finish the first draft. And again, you know, don't worry about what anyone else is thinking. The first draft, you have to be the artist. The second draft, you can be the critic. Just get your first draft done by writing as regularly as you can. And then worry about editing afterwards.
Mm. JJ, thank you so much for coming on Writers on Writing.
Absolute pleasure, Barbara. Can I add that I'm a big fan of the show?
You can.
Yeah, I absolutely love the show and the series with the writer. I mean, I think it's a tremendous show, and I think you do a great service to the writing community, so I want to thank you, too.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
That was J.J. Wilson. His wonderful novel is Damnificados, published by PM Press. Can't say enough about J.J. and his novel. Check it out. And do stay with us. We will be right back with Eden Lopuki. Don't go anywhere. Thank you. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and during the first half, we were with J.J. Amawuro-Wilson with Damnificados, a novel published by PM Press. We are back, and our next guest is Eden Lapucki. She's the author of the New York Times bestselling novel California, as well as the novella If You're Not Yet Like Me. Her fiction and nonfiction have been published in McSweeney's, The Cut, Narrative Magazine, The LA Times, and The New York Times, among others. She is a staff writer and a contributing editor at The Millions, and her next novel, Woman Number 17, will be out spring 2017. And she's here today to primarily talk about California. And before we bring her on, I want to just briefly talk about something a bookseller from Northshire Books in Manchester, Vermont said when he was on the show a few years ago. And he said, as long as you haven't read a book, no matter when that book was published, if you haven't read it, then it's a brand new book. And that's how California, Eden's book, was for me. The hardcover was published in 2014. I didn't get to it till now. And I think it's because when it was published, I was not a fan of dystopian fiction. I am now. I'm a huge fan of dystopian fiction now and have been for the last year or so. So when somehow California came up on maybe it was a Goodreads dystopian list or something, I just grabbed it and loved it. And I'm so glad to have her on. Hi, Eden.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. I'd love to hear you talk about how California came about.
Let's see. You know, I always joke that there's kind of a narrative, a myth of how a book gets made. Because once it's finished, once a book or even a short story is finished, I always try to go back and try to remember, like, what? How did this happen?
Yeah.
But I do remember a couple things. The first is that this phrase, post-apocalyptic domestic drama, popped into my head one day, and I thought, oh, wow, I'd just love to read a book like that. But I didn't think that I would write it, primarily because I don't read a lot of speculative fiction or post-apocalyptic fiction, and I just didn't feel qualified to write it. But the idea really wouldn't let me go, and I just thought it would be really interesting to read a story about a marriage but that took place at the end of the world. And then around that same time, maybe before that or after that, months later, I don't even know now, I was driving in L.A. on Sunset at night, and the streetlights above me had gone out, and it was kind of eerie. It was a stretch of Sunset in Echo Park on the east side where there weren't businesses, so it just had a very kind of deserted quality to it. And I began to think, what would it be like if the cities, you know, kind of shut down and electricity there was no more electricity, and I, you know, what if, and then I went off thinking, like, what if there wasn't enough taxes, there wasn't a strong enough tax base to pay for firefighters and police officers and schools were shutting down. I just kind of started to spin into that scenario. And those two ideas sort of came together, and I realized that I was going to write the story, whether I really wanted to or not. And kind of from there, I went. And actually, the very first scene of the book started from a writing exercise that I did with my students. So I had been kind of thinking about doing this novel, and I had vaguely, you know, little daydreams about the characters, and I had an exercise for them, which was to write about a character with a possession that no one else knows that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually do the exercises with the students just so I can time them, just so I know approximately how long they'll need, because I'm doing it as well. And so I just suddenly had this wife, I didn't know her name yet, and she had a turkey baster.
Yes.
And that was an object that her husband didn't know she had, and she was living in the woods in the middle of nowhere. And from there, I just started writing, and that is now, I mean, it's revised, but it's basically the same scene in the book that you read now.
Mm. I love that. And I love how exercises can bring out just the most amazing things. You have no idea until they're on the page that it's something you're going to use.
It's true. And, you know, I know a lot of people who really hate writing exercises, and sometimes I hate them too when I just, it's not working and it's not coming. But I never make my students share them, which I think, I mean, if they want to share, they can, but they are not required. So you can kind of be free to just write something truly stupid if that's what happens. And I think in that freedom, something magical can come. Like, I mean, at the time, I was like, okay, turkey baster, sure, whatever, whatever this means. And then it tended up to be really meaningful in the larger plot of the narrative. But I had no idea. But it didn't. I was liberated because I was just doing a writing exercise. I was sort of just letting my imagination run wild. I wasn't overthinking it, which I think is great.
Mm-hmm. Where did the characters of Cal and Frida come from?
I don't know. I never base my characters on people I know. I do know students and friends, fellow writers who do base them, you know, it's like a composite of their mother and their aunt and their friend from college and then a little dash of imagination. My characters sort of just come to me. I feel like I'm psychotic or something, almost in a dream. They start to, often I'll hear their voice first. If it's in first person, it's often a way, a turn of phrase that they use. California is written third person, but it's very close third person, so I'm really, really deeply in their perspective. So it's sort of how I see them, or how they see the world, how they're describing the room, certain elements of what's around them that are important to them. But to tell you the truth, I have no idea where Frida and Cal came from. And I hear, I get this question often because a lot of readers are very frustrated with them, Frida in particular, and I'm frustrated with her too. She's a lot more impetuous than I am, I would say. She's not cerebral at all, in a way that I think Cal is. And so I'm obviously tapping into something in myself to be able to write her, but she's not me. She's almost like a family member. Like, I love her, and she drives me crazy.
What about the alternating point of view, points of view? Was that a decision you made before you began writing, or did it sort of just happen?
I had written a novel previously to California that wasn't published, and that was written in the first-person retrospective. And by the time I was done writing that and revising it, I was just so over the first-person. So I knew that I wanted to write something in the third-person that had just a little bit more distance to give me a little bit more flexibility in the syntax and just a tiny bit of distance that I would just feel a little bit more liberated in that way. But pretty early on, I think as soon as I realized that it was going to be really primarily about this married couple and about their relationship and their conflicts, I knew that I wanted to switch. I think the question more was when in the narrative I would switch. When I first started writing it, I had it switching back and forth very quickly, but I soon realized that that would feel a little bit too abrupt for the reader, that I wanted them to sink into one narrative perspective before switching to the next one. And after I figured that out, they came pretty naturally, and I found that when I was sort of done with a sequence of events and even sort of over being with that person's point of view, it was a relief to go to the other person's point of view. And I was hoping that that would mirror the readers. And it was also fun because that way there was a lot of interesting narrative tension, too. So you would read one chapter from one character, and then I would switch to the next, and I would realize, oh, hey, they don't know any of the stuff that just happened to the other character. And so that kind of withholding became useful to me plot-wise. But I always say that the perspective switching was the only thing in the book that was relatively easy to do. It kind of came naturally. Everything else was difficult.
I'd love to hear you read from California. Would you do that?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll read the, I'm going to read the very beginning minus a curse word.
Okay.
just the first couple pages, so you don't need to know anything, really. On the map, their destination had been a stretch of green, as if they would be living on a golf course. No freeways nearby or any roads, really. Those had been left to rot years before. Frida had given this place a secret name, the Afterlife, and on their journey, when they were forced to hide in abandoned rest stops, or when they'd filled the car with the last of their gasoline, this place had beckoned. In her mind, it was a township, and Cal was the mayor. She was the mayor's wife. Of course, it was nothing like that. The forest had not been expecting that. If anything, it had tried to throw them out again and again. But they had stayed, perhaps even prospered. Now Frida could only laugh at the memory of herself over 2 years ago, dragging a duffel bag behind her with a groan, her stomach roiling, grime like she'd never imagined. Even her knees had smelled. She thought it would be easier once they arrived. She should have known better. The work didn't end then. If anything, it got worse, and for months the exhaustion and fear tick-ticked in her body like a dealer shuffling cards. At night, the darkness gave her a skinned, alive feeling, and she longed for her old childhood bed, for a bed, period. She had packed some things to comfort herself, the dead device, a matchbook from their favorite bar. Cal later called them her artifacts. In a world so disconnected from the past, her attachment to these objects had been her only strategy for remaining sane. It still was. She tried not to take them out too often, but Cal had left the house to do some digging, and he wouldn't be back for at least an hour. Even though the sky was gray, the sun weak, he'd worn his plaid button-down and a bandana around his neck. They still had a bottle of sunscreen, but it had expired and was watery as skin milk. "Stay inside for a while," he'd said before he left. Frida had linked her arms around his neck. "Where would I go?" He kissed her goodbye on the mouth, as he still did and always would. She was thinking already of the artifacts tucked away in an old briefcase, shoved under one of the unused twin cots. It had been a rough morning. Cal had latched the door behind him, and once his footsteps receded, she went right for the briefcase. From the small pile of artifacts, she picked up the abacus. She liked to pull the blue beads back and forth across the wires. She counted, she tapped, she closed her eyes. Frida had played with the abacus as a little girl, and even then had depended on its calming effect. Her brother Micah, 2 years younger, had one as well, red beads instead of blue. But one day, when he was about 7, he cut it apart and strung the beads onto a piece of yarn. He presented it to their mother as a necklace. Frida flicked at the beads. She found herself counting the days yet again. 42. "I'm late," she said aloud, and her voice in the one-room house sounded small and plaintive. The walls seemed to breathe in the words. They would keep the secret until she told Cal. "I'm late," she repeated, and willed her voice to stay steady. She'd have to tell him soon, and like this, she could not be freaked out. She would have to declare it as she would any fact. And I will end there.
Yeah, that's great. And soon we come to the turkey baster.
Yes.
So
the
was
turkey
this...
baster is the artifact that she really wants to see.
Yeah. So was this always the first chapter then?
Yeah, remarkably. It's kind of surprising to me, actually. But remarkably, that first paragraph is sort of very similar to what I wrote. And, you know, she gets the turkey baster is the scene I wrote in the class where that was the mm-hmm. object that she wanted. Of course, within that, I have braided in a lot of backstory
sure.
and things that wasn't in there originally.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. And I want to talk about something that was in this section you read and that is throughout the book. And that is your use of metaphor and simile. And I think they're just the hardest thing to do, to come up with original ones. And you had one in there, fear tick-ticked in her body like a dealer shuffling cards. But later on, you have one that I just love that goes like this. I think it's on page 95. "When his mind was still open, fluorescent as plankton." And I thought that was just stellar. And I wonder if you would talk about coming up with similes and metaphors and if it comes easy to you or what goes on.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, I'm very happy that you like those. I always feel like writers, there's a little special like thrill of coming up with a metaphor or simile that feels right. You know, it's like a little, mm-hmm. I don't know, it makes me feel very happy when I get one that works. You know, I have to say, when I'm writing well, for me, that means that I'm inside the story, meaning I'm not looking at a computer screen and a string of words. I'm not, I don't feel like I'm writing. I'm actually like deep inside the dream of the narrative, and I'm really with the characters. And now that doesn't happen every time I'm writing. Often I find that I'm really wrestling with, you know, getting the sentence structure correct, or I just can't seem to get this exposition to work, you know, all those really, like, heavy lifting problems. But the imagery actually comes to me very easily when I'm in that kind of dream state, when I'm really in the perspective of the characters. I will say that when I'm not writing, I try to do a kind of work where it's like I try to, it's not like I, let me describe this. I basically, like, let's say I was reading a book about marine life to my son, and it's about plankton, and I see, like, how bright and fluorescent it is. I'll sort of put that in my little bank mm-hmm. and think about it as something I can use later. So it's not as if I start with the mind, I start with the plankton.
Mm. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
So, you know, I might watch a dealer shuffling cards and think, like, that is a sound that I want in work, and I'll try to figure out where I can put it later. So I sort of have when I was an undergraduate, I had to do an assignment that was called Image Notebook, where we had to collect images for, like, 7 days of just cool things we saw in our everyday lives. And it was just sort of a practice of seeing and noticing. And so I've always try to do that. So I try very hard not to look at my cell phone when I'm waiting in a restaurant or I'm in line. I just try to look at everything because I feel like it feeds my writing and that those images will come back to me when I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
But imagery really does feel intuitive, so that when I am thinking about writing later, I actually feel an anxiety of, like, well, will I ever be able to come up with another metaphor again? Because it's not, it just feels like a gift from the gods that it just popped in. But it really only pops in because I'm really locked into the character and the moment of the scene.
Mm.
You know, I just like come up with them as I'm walking down the street.
Yeah, that's great. And it's something else you can do when you're waiting in a restaurant, not look at your phone, but look around, right?
Look around, right? You might see something. Like, there's a detail in the book where this isn't really an image, it's not a simile, but Frida remembers a woman putting lipstick on. She's a barista at a coffee place.
Mm-hmm.
She puts lipstick on, using the reflective surface of the espresso machine.
Right.
And that was something that I saw during the writing of my book, and I was like, I want to use that somewhere in writing because it was such an arresting image to me. So it's not quite the same thing, but it is sort of a. I'm an advocate for looking around at what's in front of you.
So will you write these things down, or do you just have a really good memory and you'll remember them later?
Sometimes I write them down, sometimes I don't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll just forget them.
And wish you had written them. What was that thing? I remember there was something really good.
I know, right? Or in the middle of the night when you have an idea and you're like, I'm going to remember this tomorrow.
Yeah.
You never remember it.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Eden Lapucki. Her book is California, published by Back Bay Books. And I love it. I loved it. I wanted to talk about suspense, because while this, I would consider this a literary novel, a literary suspense novel in my category, it's not a mystery, it's not a suspense novel, and yet many of your chapters end with cliffhangers, and I wondered if that was conscious on your part.
I would say yes and no. When I sold the novel, the contract said that my book was a literary suspense novel.
Oh, interesting.
And I laughed out loud. I was like, what? I wrote a suspense novel? I thought that was just the funniest thing. Not that I was protesting that. I just it didn't occur to me that that's what
mm-hmm.
I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I looked back on the book I had written, and then when it was more fully revised, I realized that suspense and narrative propulsion in particular is really very important to me as a writer and a reader. So as a reader, I'm always looking for books that are beautiful. You know, I also like imagery and similes, and I love voice. I like artfulness. It has to have really interesting, nuanced characters. But I also just, I love that feeling of not being able to put a novel down.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a really magical feeling. And in a world where there's so many distractions, it just is like such a juicy, wonderful part of life to just be immersed in a novel. So I always wanted to write novels like that. And at some point, I started thinking about the way that when you write a scene, A scene really doesn't work well if all the questions are answered. So I like to think of scenes as raising certain questions and answering other questions and carrying certain questions from one scene to the next. So the questions can be really minor and very specific, like, you know, will she get asked to the prom? Or there can be sort of larger thematic questions, like, will she ever be comfortable in her own skin?
Mm-hmm.
And then each scene, I want to explore those questions, ask new ones, and hopefully by the end of each scene, not everything is resolved. Otherwise, why would you turn the page to get to the next one? This book in particular, though, had a lot of unknowns and secret keeping and things that were keeping the narrative propelling forward, sort of without my even trying. It was more than the previous novel that I had written. It had that quality, I think, because the stakes were higher, you know, the end of the world, et cetera. So I noticed that about it, and I kind of leaned into it, I guess.
So how much did you know about the book before you began? And are you an outliner or a pantser? And, you know, how'd that go?
I hardly knew anything. I sometimes wish I had known more, because that might have made revising a lot easier, but I just cannot outline. I'm usually a chapter or two ahead of myself. So as I'm writing a chapter, I can see it unfolding, you know, a little bit, maybe 20 or 30 pages, what's going to happen from there. And I was probably like 70 pages into the book when I visualized the ending, but it was a very kind of just impressionistic image. And it was like glittering in the distance like a mirage, and I just needed to write towards it to figure out how I was going to get there. But I tend not to know too much, and I don't like to know too much. I fear if I wrote an outline, it would just kill the magic. And I really want to try to embody the experience of the reader as much as I can. So I want to know, like, okay, what would the reader be interested in right now? And what, you know, that kind of question. That said, usually I'll write a scene or a chapter or a series, you know, a section, and I'll stop and I'll go to my journal and I'll kind of do like a postmortem, like, okay, this is what's happened so far. This is the part that I'm unsure about, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, as I wrote, the backstory kind of emerged. So as I wrote that first scene, when she has the turkey baster, she thinks back to where she got the turkey baster. And I actually did. That flashback was something I did in the in-class exercise. So she thinks back to the store that she bought it from and how they were using gold paper things, and the mall was now probably deserted now. So kind of as I was having her think back, I was the destruction of L.A., which is where they fled from, came into focus. But that said, after I sold the book, I had to add a lot more exposition about Frida's brother, Micah, and he was a terrorist, and I had to do a lot of exposition about what his group was like. And the last third of the book, there was a lot that needed to be reworked because it wasn't quite coming together. So, you know, I had to pay for it later, not planning.
Yeah, well, you mentioned exposition and having to get more in after you sold the book, and that's always such a tricky deal for writers, I think, flashbacks and exposition. Can you talk any at all about that in terms of somehow balancing it or you know, making sure you don't go overboard with it? Do you have any rules or
what? Well, I tend to really love flashbacks, as evidenced by the fact that every editor who was interested in the book told me I would have to cut about 80 pages. I had all these flashbacks about Micah and Cal at Plank. I could write a whole, like, 500-page novel just about their memories. Mm-hmm. And I have found that, actually, there are some readers who prefer flashbacks more than others. And so I can tell, because some people, it's very interesting to me, there are some readers who tend to prefer the first half of the novel that is a lot more flashback and exposition heavy, and some readers who prefer the second half of the novel, which is much more oriented to scene and present action. And it's just kind of fascinating to think about why we find certain elements of narrative appealing, more appealing than others.
Mm-hmm.
With flashback, I mean, I tend to think if the flashback is sort of swallowing your narrative, then maybe the question should be, why are you telling this part of the story? Like, maybe the story is actually the flashback. I didn't think that was an issue with mine, because I was more interested in the aftermath and the sense of trauma that they were dealing with and what was going to happen once they left their isolated shed. Some of the flashbacks happened quite easily, like the one where she's just looking at the turkey baster and thinking about the store and kind of moving in and out. And I felt like I was braiding time okay, meaning I would use the present moment to make her think back to something and then bring her back to the present, like never losing either time frame. There are other ones that were harder to kind of move in. It's almost like playing Tetris, like where can I put this passage? When do I need to move back? It's so technical. I don't think there's any rules about it. It just can sometimes be really challenging and frustrating because you want to make sure that you don't want the reader to forget what the present is, I guess. Mm. You don't want them to go so far back that they sort of forget where they are. And, you know, I have heard from readers who felt like there wasn't enough exposition, that they wanted to know more answers about what happened to the world. So that's kind of interesting to me as well, because I was always thinking, well, these are two laymen who have been, you know, they don't have the technology that we have. They don't have every answer at their fingertips. They've been isolated, so they don't exactly know every reason for what has happened. And I liked that idea. That was scarier to me than me giving exposition about every single breakdown of, you know, the American government, for instance. I did notice that if I said even one thing, like in a draft, I had some reference, I think it was reference to China, and my editor was like, okay, unless you're really going to go into international relations right now, I think we should cut this. Because with speculative fiction, you know, you open a can of worms with just a single phrase. So that was a new challenge for me, because I've never written speculative fiction before.
Well, there's so much more to talk about, and maybe when your next book comes out, we can talk more. I would love that.
Oh, I love that.
And I wanted to also say before we close that you have just a million wonderful blurbs here, and one that's especially funny to me is by Stephen Colbert, who said, it's like it's like eat, pray for something to eat.
I know, isn't that so great?
That's great. What a great blurb.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much, Eden, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for reading my book and asking me these great questions.
You're welcome. That was Eden Lapookie. Her book is California, published by Back Bay Books. And I did love it. It did keep me turning the pages. Great cliffhangers at the end of chapters. If you like speculative fiction or dystopian fiction at all, this is a good one. So pick it up. Go to the library. Somehow get your hands on it. That's it for today. I'm going to leave you now. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You can find many shows that have been on the air on penonfire.com. This one will be podcast soon as well. Come back next week. I'm not sure if it's Nicole or Marie, but someone will be here with another good show. Thank you so much.